The history of Georgian wines can be traced back 8,000 years, but the modern Georgian wine industry is fairly young in the grand scheme of the world's wines. It was early in the 80s when the country opened up to the Western countries that their wines became influenced by modern techniques. My guest, Lisa Granik, author of Georgia, a winemaking country, thoroughly described the history and the region of the country. She says that the number of producers increased by double digit in the time of making the book. Georgian winemakers have always been committed to their tradition. It is the native grapes and the ancient amphora called Coevre that attract consumers globally and make Georgia a unique wine country. In this episode, we discuss the Kakheti winemaking technique, the grape varieties of the country, and what she thinks would be a good start for your journey to the country's wines. Hi, I'm Mattia Scarpazza, and this is the Looking Into Wine podcast. Wine and winemaking can be complex, but this podcast has a simple mission. We want to give you the skills and tools to harness your passion about wine. Through this series, we will shine a spotlight on some of the different regions, processes, and concepts that shape the fascinating world of wine. I hope you enjoy the show and your own journey, Looking Into Wine. Welcome, everybody, to Looking Into Wine. Today's guest is Lisa Granik, author of The Wines of Georgia. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
So your book is on Georgia, and it's a very interesting country. How is it to visit it? And I don't expect many people have visited it.
It's a very interesting place to visit because it's actually very different from many other wine regions. Not only because the culture is so old, but first of all, it's rather rough, difficult to get there. There aren't that many direct flights. And of course, now with the COVID pandemic, tourism is way down. So we're trying to visit it virtually by drinking the wines. But when you go, it's a country that when you see it, it has several different layers all at once. So you have ancient history. It's both Eastern and Western. And then there still is a Soviet Russian overlay. It's more of a Soviet overlay than a Russian overlay, but it permeates the architecture, certainly, and the layout of the city of Tbilisi, and certainly also the buildings in the countryside. So you have, when you go there, there's certain very old classic Georgian elements that stand out. But at the same time, it really is a crossroads because it was part of the Silk Road. While Georgians have always stayed in one place, there is a diaspora now. But they got there and they've stayed, but other people have come and gone and have left their mark.
And I expect it to be still quite rural, or how people picture?
Sure. Tbilisi is an urban city. In some ways, if you've been to Jerusalem, it's reminiscent of Jerusalem in some ways. Very old parts, lots of hustle and bustle. But the downtown area is itself rather small. And then apart from the other major city, Kutaisi in the west, it is a rural country, though most of the population does live in the cities.
I see. Well, obviously, you traveled the country many times prior to the book. You were a lawyer. You traveled the country beforehand, and you've been up and down the country for like 20 years, I believe.
Yeah, a little more than 20, 25 years at this point. I think it's almost 30 years at this point. But right, I've been all around most of the regions of the country. I certainly have been in all of the wine regions many times. And have seen the country change.
And one of the interesting points in all the book, it was in the end when you were saying how the number of wineries in the making of the book have doubled almost in numbers.
When I first went, we're not going to count that because that was the Soviet period, but let's just say about 10 years ago, there were a number of wineries. But what's happened is that, it's a very agricultural society. And there's not, unlike, let's say, Italy that has pasta and it has rice and it has industry, Georgia doesn't have anything of that sort. But everybody made wine at home, or seemingly everybody made wine at home. And as people looked to find something to do in the current economy, it became very popular to suddenly take the wine that you were making at home and then decide you were going to commercialize it. that is why people, and then this was also supported by the government, that recognized that there was an interest in niche wines, and the government has given a great deal of financial support to people who then want to commercialize their wines. And so we've gone from a handful to over 900 in 10 years.
Wow. And they are still, as you said, quite eradicated in their origin and their traditions.
Absolutely, very much rooted in their tradition. While there are some European grape varieties that are grown, the overwhelming majority of what's planted and what is going to be is being replanted now are the indigenous varieties. But it's also just to note that when we talk about those 900 wineries, there are maybe 20 that actually produce the vast majority of the volume. And at least 800 of those 900, maybe they have one cuvée, you know, they produce 500 bottles, 1,000 bottles. I mean, they may sell it, but they're very, very tiny.
Yes, I expect that would be quite difficult to find outside Georgia. But the interest is growing. It's definitely one of the countries that people are looking at, especially for the grape varieties. There are about 300 to 400 grape varieties.
There are over 500. If you include Abkhazia and some other, there's some contested varieties. They say there are over 600. There certainly are over 520 odd varieties. Some of them are not so much clones, but mutations of one another. And some have certain, you know, it's not like in Portugal where there are lots of different names, but many of them have two different names, but it's the same variety. There are at least 500 odd distinct varieties. However, not all of them are great for making wine. Some of them are table grape, better as table grapes.
And what are the for who is coming new to the country and they don't know much about Georgian wine, what are the go-to grapes that you think that there would be like?
Well, the vast in red and white, I mean, the most well-known grape varieties are white, are Cazzatelli and Saperavi among the reds. And, you know, Cazzatelli is about, I want to say 60, I can't remember. It's well over half of the production. And Saperavi far and away dominates all of the red wines. Those are and both of these varieties are from the eastern Georgia, the region of Kakheti, which actually produces 70% of Georgians' wine. It's hot and warm there, and the wines are pretty big and relatively powerful. And there's increased interest in western Georgia, which is divided from eastern Georgia by a small mountain range, the Liki Mountain Range. And because it's influenced more by the Black Sea, you have lighter, fresher wines. And there's some interesting wines, you know, Tolikoordi and Tsitska are two of the white grape varieties. And then there are a couple of other relatively obscure, you know, Mujeratuli, Alexandruli, or Traveri are some of the varieties from the West.
I'll have to write down the names and the show notes so we find them, because they're very difficult to remember, to pronounce.
They're very difficult to pronounce. Georgian only has 5 vowels. English, I think, has 26 because we have diphthongs and long and short and so forth. They have 5 vowels, and so they have lots of consonant clusters, and they have letters and sounds that we don't have in English. So it's very, very, it's challenging for a foreigner to say them. Yeah.
So when you were saying about Kakheti and the other region in your book, I mean, I think the brilliant job it was how you divided and you went down every single region and write all the detail. And that, for me, was very interesting, because a priori here for your book, there were many book published on Georgia. And I think you managed to do a proper job with it.
Well, you know, thank you very much. There are a number of books on Georgia, and most of them tell the story of the Kveveri, and they try to convey the spirit of the people. But they don't, and they tell the story of the Kveveri, but they don't go into detail as a proper wine book to look at the terroir. And in fact, for a variety of reasons, some of which I think I detail in the book, Georgians themselves don't even understand their terroirs. And, you know, I basically followed the maps. And in fact, in writing the book, in doing the research, because I spent time traveling around the country and asking people questions. And very often I found that people didn't know the answers to my questions. I mean, they had never even thought of some of the things that I was talking about, you know, in terms of digging soil pits and looking at diurnal temperature variations. They might have some impression, but most producers never, would never have a daily log of, you know, of what to identify how one growing season was different from another one. But in doing the research, I found out that, back in the late 1800s and the beginning of the 20th century, you know, you can say a lot of bad things about the Soviet Union or about Russia, but the level of science was world class. And there were a number of scholars that went and tried to detail the Georgian winelands. And so in some ways I wasn't starting from nothing, but there were people and there were several different studies. Nobody was comprehensive and nobody looked at it with the knowledge that I have. What we've learned about viticulture and winemaking since the 1980s. And so I was able to take the information I had and follow with, you know, it was a couple of guys and one woman, and they talked about different regions and what they thought the top, you know, what the top terroirs were, whether there was a sweet spot in a particular region and so forth. And I relied very heavily on those Russian and Georgian materials for the book.
And as you say in the book, also the Russian, they were very good at promoting the wine of Georgia throughout their history in the country, or so that flourish and they've been able to survive also.
Well, yeah, sure. Actually, you know, now some of it was Georgia. I always joke that, you know, Georgia is like the, you know, from an American perspective, Georgia is like the Soviet or the Russian Florida, or maybe it's like from England, you could say it's the south of Portugal, right? And it's a place where people go to escape the cold. And because the people are so different, the food is fantastic. It was always a very exotic place for Russian travelers, for vacationers. So there was that appeal of Georgia in the imperial period. When wine was drunk among Georgians, but of course it was the elite who could buy and ship wine, and they discovered Georgian wine in some ways. When you move forward to the Soviet period, it's not accidental, but because Stalin was Georgian, ran the Communist Party, and was a dictator over the country, he liked Georgian wine. He didn't drink vodka so much, they say. But actually there's a book, a food historian, I want to say at University of Illinois, I can't remember offhand, but, there was no question that during the Stalin period, the Soviet leaders privileged Georgian wine and Georgian food. And Stalin had chefs, he had food, he had wine brought from Georgia to Moscow throughout his reign, however you want to call it, his dictatorship. And it was simply regarded and touted as being the best in the Soviet Union. And that branding of Georgian wine as being great wine has lasted up until this point in Russia and in all the countries of the former Soviet Union.
I expect a good market for them still is Russia.
Very much. It is very much, yes.
When it comes to the main region, Kakheti, as correct me if I'm saying it wrong, by the way, because
Kakheti, yeah, it's the H. The H is a rough one.
So the main grape variety is the white grape variety is Rakszeteli.
Rakszeteli, like you said, you kind of mumble the R.
Rakszeteli,
like it's a cat sitting. Arcatzatelli, like a cat sitting by the television kind of thing.
Arcatzatelli.
Right, Arcatzatelli.
Arcatzatelli. And obviously, the region is also famous for the use of Kvevri.
Actually, the whole country made wine in Kvevri.
Okay.
And there were different styles, different shapes. Some were fatter in the middle and some were narrower and long and some had ornamentation on the side. So there was a difference between Western and Eastern Kvevri, but the whole country made wine in Kvevri. The real issue is, and wine was grown throughout all of Georgia. Part of the problem is that when phylloxera and various fungal, you know, it was basically during the 19th century, when Russia invaded and annexed Georgia in the early part of the 1800s, trade increased. And with trade through the Black Sea came vine diseases. So oidium, downy mildew, and then phylloxera all came and it worked from the west to the east. and really destroyed the Western Georgian vineyards. And what happened was they panicked, as you know, most growers did throughout the world. And because Western Georgia is more humid, they ended up planting a lot of hybrids. And so the quality of Western Georgian wine, which was considered to be very high because they had their own varieties too, it just went totally down the tubes. And Eastern Georgia consolidated itself as being seeming to be the quality wine region because they were still, it's drier, and they were able to, they grew their own grapes. And then when you had, during the planned economy in the Soviet period, when growers didn't have a choice of what to grow, they were told what to plant. And in the West, they largely planted more hybrids. And in the East, it was the native varieties. And that accounted for the difference in the perception and difference in quality. That will change in time.
There's a great difference between the two regions. And also you were saying that the name of the quarries, one side is, I think, is Churi. Is the name
in the West, it's called, right. In the West, it's called a Churi. And in the East, it's a Kvevri. Right.
Okay. How do they typically produce the wine using the Kvevri? What was the Kakhetian technique so called?
Well, the Kakhetian technique is, and this is primarily, I'm going to talk about white grapes because with red grapes, it's more or less the same thing as fermenting wine in any kind of cement vat. Because you macerate with the skins. But what will happen is that the grapes are crushed, and the grapes and the skins, and sometimes if it is a warm enough vintage so that the stems are ripe, the stems and the will also go into the vat. They'll punch it down. The fermentation starts. Sometimes they don't put in all of the stems. Sometimes it's only a portion. It all depends on the season. And the fermentation, the alcoholic fermentation proceeds with everything in there. After the alcoholic fermentation concludes, then the Kvevri will be sealed. And typically often now they use glass so you can see inside, but there will be, glass or a stone lid. It is sealed with, could be clay. Now more often it's a food grade silicone. To make sure that, and it's usually right before the fermentation is over, and there's a little airlock so that the oxygen comes, anything, the CO2 comes out, nothing can go in, and it creates a hermetic seal for the wine, and the wine will be left in contact with stem, skin, seeds, and it depends, again, what percentage of all of those things depend on the wine grower, and it will be left there typically for anywhere from a month to traditionally 3 to 6 months, and some do it even longer. And then you open up the Kvevri, and after about 3 months, the skins and all of the solids will have settled, and you will have clear wine on top that you can ladle out and enjoy.
That does sound like very antique, and they've been doing something similar for the last 8,000 years.
Yeah. That's right. That's right.
But these the queries, just to make clear, it represent what, the 20% of the production or the 1% of the production?
1%, maybe 2 to 3% now, but it is a minuscule percentage because it is so labor intensive. We'll see that figure, may have grown a tiny bit because some of the larger producers have seen the interest in these wines, and some of the larger producers have established large Kvevri cellars. But it's still, when you consider the time that it takes it and the labor, it's still the labor involved, even if they're trying to come up with more efficient ways to wash the Kvevri and keep them sanitary, and to bottle from Kvevri, all the same, it's still a tiny fraction of the entire production.
And another style that seems to be quite popular in Georgia is off dry, semi sweet, both white and red.
Well, sure. Now the off dry, that apparently started in the same way as Amarone did, Ricciotto. There, you make the wine and you intend it to finish the fermentation, and then it doesn't finish. Now the question is, why did it not finish? And what you have to remember too, that before the 20th century in Georgia, wine was made by peasants, Okay, that's the word they use, still use. Wine was made by peasants. And in Georgia before the Soviet Union, or before Soviet power, the peasants were illiterate. There was over 90% illiteracy rate, which is why the traditions of Georgian wine were not written down. The priests didn't keep records as they did, say, the Benedictine monks in France, right? There was these works that were written, like I was mentioning, by the Russians. These were some of the first, they wrote down what the peasants were doing and how they did it and the variations. So what happened was there were times when they would open the vat and the wine was still sweet. And there was a chemist winemaker who did some research as to why, because they didn't know what the reasons were. And it turns out that actually Georgian yeast are very powerful, and they definitely, like German yeast, they have the power to ferment through to dryness. However, what they can't withstand is thermal shock. So this was really happening in the mountainous regions in Racha, where you harvest late. It would be September, maybe even into November. The fermentation begins, but by then winter is setting in, and it might be nice during the day, but it got very cold at night. And so the fermentation would start, but after a week, perhaps, it would all of a sudden, the yeast would die because there was too much temperature variation. But then what happened was that, of course, the Russians have always been known to have a sweet tooth. And the semi-sweet wines became very, very popular in Russia. And they were popularized and remain very popular to this day. They became big brand names. And actually, they were so popular during the Soviet period. And the area which is delimited, Khvanchkara, which was the original famous and still is the most famous semi-sweet, most expensive. These are the most expensive grapes in Georgia, actually. Once that became so popular, there was insufficient demand. And so the Soviets then developed a semi-sweet white wine, Tvishi, from a small village, a couple of villages just west of Khvanchkara in Racha, and then ultimately some other variants in Kakheti as well.
I would like to try some of these, and I expect they're quite difficult to. I mean, I am in London, and you start seeing them around the country a bit more, but they're still a very small.
It's very, very tiny. And the thing that's interesting about the semi-sweet whites are of less interest to just me personally, and I think probably of less interest to most professional wine people. The reds are quite a curiosity, because they're semi-sweet. They have roughly 35 grams residual sugar, but they have high acidity and they have tannin. And Khvanchkara, they're more delicate. They don't have that much tannin. Kinsmaraouli in Kakheti has much more tannin because that's made with Safarovi. But these wines, are not that far away from some of the wines that pretend to be, say that they're dry, but they're sweet from California. But they have more substance, but they definitely have more tannin and more acidity. And as such, with a slight chill, they can be very refreshing. And for people who, like wines of that style, they go with very spicy food. They work with Indian food, for example. But a lot of, they're actually crowd pleasers for people who sometimes have less, aren't looking for tremendous nuance in their wine. I mean, they're not meditation wines by any stretch of the imagination.
Well, I expect with over 500 grapes, there would be a style of grape and a style of wine produced in the country for everybody.
In some ways, yeah. I mean, you have very strong, powerful wines, and some wines that really are worth thinking about. The thing is, though, the culture was not one that fetishized wine in a sense, or made it out to be something that you talked about and thought at great length. There were professional winemakers that developed in the 20th century. But there's not a tradition of aging wine that we have in the West. There really isn't even, most people made wine to enjoy and to drink at the table. You had it with food. And there was a very long, most wine was often drunk by men, and they would have it at dinner. The women would serve, and it was very common for men. There was a, it was a bit, there was a lot of one-upsmanship. I mean, for going, people would go through, individual people would go through 3, 4, 5, 6 bottles at a sitting.
That sounds like a good evening.
If, perhaps. I don't know. I'm not sure it led to a good morning, but it could have been a good evening. Right.
When it comes to like the last 10 years, 10, 15 years, it sounds that a lot of things have changed. Do you see any other innovation in the country that are coming, part of new producers or any new technique that have been?
I think the biggest change is going back to the Kvevery, okay, in a professional way. And looking at how to basically trying to take a scientific approach that might have been done by professionals in the Soviet period, but now people are experimenting more with making wine in Kvevery and then putting it into oak barrels, or looking at other techniques, you know, because there's been such, whether it's oak alternatives, making wine in Kvevery and throwing in staves in the Kvevery, things of that sort. People are, you know, in some ways, all bets are off and people are trying all sorts of different things if they can afford to.
As you said, there are quite a few large wineries and I expect they're doing a lot of experimentation.
Yes, right.
And so if I was to try a Georgian wine for the first time, what would be like your go-to couple of region or style you think it would be good to an introduction to the
right? Well, and that it depends on whether you want to like dive in fully or whether you're going to tiptoe. And if you want to tiptoe, the wines from the West are and actually I should say, when I described how wine is made, I was discussing the Kekhetian technique in Western Georgia, because the stems particularly didn't get ripe. The time on skins was often much shorter. And so, and often they may not have been made with the skins at all. And so the wines from the West, particularly, you know, the whites from Imereti, for example, can be light and fresh and are less exotic. The Saporavi wines is a general rule. Saporavi is a very noble grape variety. It can be made into a sparkling wine. It can be made into a sparkling rosé. You know, Saporavi is a Tinturier grape variety, so the juice is pink. You can't make a white wine from it. So it's a natural rosé. And then it can make a semi-sweet, as we were talking about. But then it's known for making a relatively full-bodied red wine, terroir dependent. But in some ways, the closest analogy is to Syrah, because it has some of the, you know, these meaty characteristics and dark berry flavors that can go into torrefaction and licorice and coffee and dark chocolate, and if it's in wood, maybe some vanilla tones. So it's a beautiful grape variety that ages, and so they can be beautiful meditation wines, actually. But then when you're really diving in to see what it's all about, Cazzatelli that is fermented in Kvevery, in my view, there's a reason it's the most well known, most widely planted grape variety. It is a perfectly fine wine made in stainless steel, but it really comes alive and comes into its own in the Kvevery. And you can work with there's a tremendous amount of phenols that come from the stems and the skins that can give the wine delicious texture, and that evolves in bottle. Those are some of the most interesting.
I would really like to try some of them. They sound delicious. And I think also Georgia is a fascinating country also to go and visit. It would be an amazing experience to go and visit as a country.
It's an experience, and the Kvevery wines are an experience too. And often I say when you try them for the first time, the white Kekhetian wines, you have to think back to the first time you tried either beer or wine or sherry, something that's about umami, something very strange, because the first time you have it in your mouth, in some ways, you know, it's a white wine that drinks like a red, but the flavors are so very different. And most people don't have this epiphany of, oh my God, this is delicious, they are wines that you have to sort of open, you know, push the envelope and open the horizons of your mind somewhat to appreciate what the flavors are like. And it takes time, I think, for anybody, particularly Westerns who are experienced and have grown up drinking wines, whether it's from California with the New World or Old World, it's a different expression, and it takes some time to really appreciate what they're about and to be able to distinguish the good ones from the bad ones.
Now that is a skill, so I think not many people have at the moment. I think also for me it's interesting about Georgia that a lot of, you see a lot, but you see producers from around Europe or around the, especially New World, they're going and they dip into the country and they're trying to bring the Cuvée into other part of the world. I can think of north of Italy and like...
Well, Grosvenor is the one who went to Georgia and really started that move back. But now it's in, you know, they make Cuvée wine. Actually, it's a Georgian producer making Cuvée wine in Australia. Wines are being made in Oregon, Austria, and Spain has always had the Tinaja, of course, but though the Tinaja is above ground, not below ground.
That's a difference for it. I think that the future of people is going to see Georgia as the place where to go to for this style, and I think that is going to be the driving force of the country.
I mean, it's very much, you know, the Georgians own the Cuvée. It's very much part of their history and their heritage and their identity.
Fantastic. Just a last question. What do you think is like some of the, we haven't touched any of this, but what is could be the problems of any, can you think of in Georgia, like the drought or any, or Cuvée?
Well, climate change is a big issue in Georgia in a number of ways. Number one, as elsewhere in the world, when there are storms, they are more intense. In Kakheti, actually, a couple of weeks ago, was hit by 45 minutes of a very serious hail, 45 minutes of hail, and with very big hailstones that really did devastation to, I'm not sure how many, but many thousands of hectares of vines. So there's more severity of hail events. There also is less, there's more droughts, and there's actually less snow in the winter, which is a huge problem in the springtime because then there's less groundwater during the very hot summer. And then the summers have gotten increasingly hot. So what people are doing is they're planting higher up in the hills because at least, or in the, on the mountainside because it's cooler, and they're experimenting with different grape varieties, to see, you know, now the positive is that in the rest of the world, I heard José Riamos, the vine geneticist in Switzerland a few years ago, said that some of the vines in the future may well be some of the Georgian grape varieties because they are more heat and drought tolerant, namely Kateteli and Saparavi. Though the Georgians themselves are, they are selecting and propagating, a variety of their old vines, indigenous vines that were knocked out by phylloxera. And they're trying to bring them back. So there's more genetic diversity.
I think then Georgia is going to be more and more talked about, and it was going to play a bigger role in the next 10, 15 years.
No question. Yeah. And I think the wines will become better, more interesting as people learn more about quality grape growing and modern winemaking practices. I mean, there's a steep learning curve, but I think there are going to be more grape varieties, more options, and better raw material and better wines moving forward.
Well, I thank you so much for this half an hour where we explore everything. That was Lisa Greenwich, author of The Wines of Georgia, which I invite everybody to have a read because it's such a detailed book. It's not an easy read, but I think it's well worth it. Thank you so much, Lisa.
You joined the conversation with Lisa Greenwich, Master of Wine, on Looking into Wine, author of the book Georgia, a Winemaking Country. Find the link below for the book. Be sure to go to mattiascarpazza.com and remember to join our mailing list now to receive the latest news and projects that are coming up. If you like the podcast, please give us a 5-star review and tell your friends to subscribe. We are available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeartMusic, and every major listening app, as well as at mattiascarpazza.com. where you can listen to the podcast earlier. A special thanks to today's guest, Lisa Granik, Master of Wine, music produced by Samuele Di Nardo, audio editing by Tommaso Ascoli.